time for Off the Wall. Okay, sorry about the delay. Whenever you hear a long pause like that, you know I'm busy doing something, and I was queuing something up in the computer, which I can't do before the show because the show before this program also uses the computer, and if I were to play with the computer while it was playing from the computer, well, it's a Mac, all right? Let's just leave it at that. Yeah, interesting items in the news that we're going to be focusing on in just a moment. But first, I'd like to remind people, anybody, especially in the Midwestern part of the United States, that this weekend coming up is that wondrous event in the celestial heavens that you may sometimes witness if you're lucky, called the Dayton Hamvention. That's right, it's where ham radio people from all over the world gather, tens of thousands of them. These are people who walk around with antennas mounted to their heads. And you think I'm kidding, I'm not. And it's great. We hang out there for... I'm not even a ham radio person myself. I'm just somebody who knows a lot of ham people and plays with technology and breaks things. But once a year, we head out there in the 2600 van, bring a whole lot of hacker things with us, and set up shop right there at the Dayton Hamvention. So if you're in Ohio, by all means, come by this this weekend. And I know this... This program is broadcast on shortwave on Saturday nights. In fact, I have a hunch that a bunch of us will be listening to the program on Saturday night, gathered around a shortwave someplace, probably because I encouraged you to. Well, hi there. And now that I've just spoken to myself in the future, let me just remind people that I don't know what the website is, but if you plug in the word Hamvention, which is not really a word, into any search engine, you'll get all the details. I think it's at a place called the Harrah Arena. And it's this coming... You know, it was really nice in this station when they had the calendar up on the wall. But like with everything around here, there's debate, you know, and there's this contentious group that is opposed to calendars. And they succeeded in having the calendar removed. The anti-calendar faction. So I don't know what the actual date is. I can figure it out, though. If I see something with today's date on it... Oh, here's a fax that I got. And assuming my fax machine gives the correct date, today is the 17th of May, which means tomorrow is Wednesday, 18th, 19th, 20th. Okay, so the 20th, 21st, and 22nd of May, 2005, is when this... miraculous event takes place, but we'd like to see you down there in Dayton. Or if you're on the way, I think we'll be taking I-80, so camp out by the side of the interstate and you'll see the 2600 van go by. We'll be hitting the horn about every 5 seconds or so, so that's how you'll recognize us coming, in case you fall asleep or something. And we might even bring wireless connectivity to the event. Yeah, we'll see. Okay, so today, very interesting bits of news coming out. I woke up this morning this testimony from Capitol Hill. The interesting thing was, it wasn't on American television. It was only on British television, because it involved a British citizen who was vehemently denying what he was being accused of by the United States. Now, I know we're not allowed to see BBC in this country, but that doesn't stop me. What I'd like to know, though, is why this wasn't on C-SPAN, because it was taking place as part of a Senate hearing. And let me find you the exact story as it was printed. It's British MP George Galloway. He has told U.S. senators who accused him of profiting from Iraq oil dealings their claims were the mother of all smokescreens. That's right. In a combative performance before a Senate committee, the Respect Coalition MP accused the U.S. lawmakers of being cavalier with justice. Now, this is a guy who's very outspoken against the war, against the U.S. action over there. And it's interesting how whenever you do something like that, whenever you're pretty outspoken and, well, you don't even have to be a foreigner anymore. You could be a citizen of this country. You'll get demonized. You'll get accused of all kinds of things. And lately, you may have noticed this, the U.S. government has been going crazy accusing people of things, especially complicity in the Iraq for oil scandal, as if that's a big scandal in and of itself. Yes, some people stole money, even if it's true, which there's a lot of debate as to whether it is true. But even if it were to be found to be completely accurate and true, it ignores the real scandal, the scandal of what's going on in Iraq today and how it came about. And you just have to wonder, you know, these guys, these lawmakers who have blood on their hands, how dare they go out and start accusing other people of wrongdoing, especially with regard to a country like Iraq? Look to yourselves. Well, you know, I can't say it nearly as well as George Galloway said today. Now, you might have seen excerpts of this. You might have seen some coverage of it on some American media. But on BBC, they basically just focused on this for a couple of hours. What I'd like to do is just play a section. The section I woke up to, in fact. And this is a good way to get your day started when you turn on the TV and this is what you hear.
In your capacity as a private citizen. Before we begin, pursuant to Rule 6, all witnesses who testify before this subcommittee are required to be sworn. This time I would ask you to rise and please raise your right hand. Do you swear the testimony you're about to give before the subcommittee is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, to help you God? We will be using a timing system today, Mr. Galloway. We have 10 minutes for opening statement. If you need more time, we'll certainly accommodate that, and you may proceed.
Senator, I am not now, nor have I ever been, an oil trader, and neither has anyone on my behalf. I have never seen a barrel of oil, owned one, bought one, sold one, and neither has anybody on my behalf. Now, I know that standards have slipped over the last few years in Washington, but for a lawyer, you're remarkably cavalier with any idea of justice. I'm here today, but last week, you already found me guilty. You traduced my name around the world without ever having asked me a single question, without ever having contacted me, without ever having written to me or telephoned me, without any contact with me whatsoever. And you call that justice. Now, I want to deal with the pages that relate to me in this dossier, and I want to point out areas where there are, let's be charitable and say, errors. And then I want to put this in the context that I believe it ought to be. On the very first page of your document about me, you assert that I have had many meetings with Saddam Hussein. This is false. I have had two meetings with Saddam Hussein, once in 1994 and once in August of 2002. By no stretch of the English language can that be described as many meetings with Saddam Hussein. As a matter of fact, I've met Saddam Hussein exactly the same number of times as Donald Rumsfeld met him. The difference is, Donald Rumsfeld met him to sell him guns and to give him maps the better to target those guns. I met him to try and bring about an end to sanctions, suffering, and war, and on the second of the two occasions, I met him to try and persuade him to allow Dr. Hans Blix and the United Nations weapons inspectors back into the country. A rather better use of two meetings with Saddam Hussein than your own Secretary of State for Defense made of his. ...of the Hussein regime. This is false. I have brought along here a dossier for all the members of your committee of statements by me as early as the 15th of March 1990, in which I condemn the Saddam Hussein dictatorship in the most withering terms, a stance I have taken since around about the time you were an anti-Vietnam War demonstrator. I was an opponent of Saddam Hussein when British and American governments and businessmen were selling him guns and gas. I used to demonstrate outside the Iraqi embassy when British and American officials were going in and out doing commerce. You will see from the official parliamentary record, Hansard, from the 15th of March 1990 onwards, voluminous evidence that I have a rather better record of opposition to Saddam Hussein than you do and than any member of the British or American governments do. Now you say in this document, you quote a source, you have the gall to quote a source without ever having asked me if the allegation from the source was true, that I am, quote, the owner of a company which has made substantial profits from trading in Iraqi oil. Senator, I do not own any companies beyond a small company whose entire purpose, whose sole purpose, is to receive the income from my journalistic earnings from my employer, Associated Newspapers in London. I do not own a company that's been trading in Iraqi oil. And you had no business to carry a quotation, utterly unsubstantiated and false, implying otherwise. Now, you have nothing on me, Senator, except my name on lists of names from Iraq, many of which have been drawn up after the installation of your puppet government in Baghdad.
Oh, yeah, kick ass.
If you had any of the letters against me that you had against Zhirinovsky and even Pasqua, they would have been up there in your slideshow for the members of your committee today. You have my name on lists provided to you by the Dofer inquiry, provided to him by the convicted bank robber and fraudster and con man Ahmed Chalabi, who many people, to their credit in your country, now realize played a decisive role in leading your country into the disaster in Iraq. There were 270 names on that list originally. That's somehow been filleted down to the names you chose to deal with in this committee. Some of the names on that committee included the former secretary to His Holiness Pope John Paul II, the former head of the African National Congress presidential office, and many others who had one defining characteristic in common. They all stood against the policy of sanctions and war, which you vociferously prosecuted and which has led us to this disaster. You quote Mr. Taha Yassin Ramadan. Well, you have something on me. I've never met Mr. Taha Yassin Ramadan. Your subcommittee apparently has. But I do know that he's your prisoner. I believe he's in Abu Ghraib prison. I believe he's facing war crimes charges, punishable by death. In these circumstances, knowing what the world knows about how you treat prisoners in Abu Ghraib prison, in Bagram Air Base, in Guantanamo Bay, including, I may say, British citizens being held in those places, I'm not sure how much credibility anyone would put on anything you managed to get from a prisoner in those circumstances. But you quote 13 words from Taha Yassin Ramadan, whom I have never met. If he said what he said, then he is wrong. And if you had any evidence that I had ever engaged in any actual oil transaction, if you had any evidence that anybody ever gave me any money, it would be before the public and before this commitment today. Because I agreed with your Mr. Greenblatt. Your Mr. Greenblatt was absolutely correct. What counts is not the names on the paper. What counts is where's the money, Senator? Who paid me hundreds of thousands of dollars of money? The answer to that is nobody. And if you had anybody who ever paid me a penny, you would have produced them here today. Now, you refer at length to a company named in these documents as Eredio Petroleum.
Okay, well, you get the point. This guy kicks ass. He really, he's giving it to the senators who accused him of this financial wrongdoing and threw it right back into their faces, this whole disaster known as Iraq. And it doesn't stop there. Monday, Russian politician Vladimir Zhirinovsky, he also denied the committee's accusations that he accepted millions of dollars in Iraqi oil allocations. The Senate committee's report also accused former French Minister Charles Pasqua of receiving oil rights from Iraq, something he has vehemently denied. He says he has been falsely named in the Iraq oil scandal. Now, it's great. There's an Iraq oil scandal, but there's no Iraq war scandal. You know, what's it going to take? It's going to take more people like this guy, you know, like George Galloway, to shake people up, make them realize how wrong they are. Anyway, former French Minister Charles Pasqua told French TV that U.S. senators who accused him of receiving oil rights from Saddam Hussein were gripped by an anti-French obsession. He said the U.S. was convinced that France had opposed the war in Iraq out of economic self-interest, and he said he had not been contacted by the U.S. Senate inquiry, something that George Galloway also mentioned. Mr. Pasqua, who was Interior Minister in the 1980s and 1990s, said it seemed obvious to him that the allegations against him were an attempt to tarnish Mr. Chirac. However, the effort was bound to fail, he added. Perhaps also those who are targeting Jacques Chirac through me ignore that the nature of our relationship has changed, at least politically, and they are mistaken if they think that I am in a position to influence French policy. He said there was a real obsession in the U.S. An obsession was consist of saying that if France took a hostile stance against American intervention in Iraq, it was because of economic interests or privileged relations it might have had with Saddam Hussein. Okay, unbelievable. So we have that going on. There is a scandal. I mean, whether or not the media chooses to focus attention on it, there is a big scandal. A lot of people know it. But getting the American public to hear about it, well, you won't get that anytime soon. Unless they're privy to the story. Unless the facts are on the front page of the newspaper. Claims in a recently uncovered British memo that intelligence was being fixed to support the Iraq war as early as mid-2002 are flat-out wrong, according to White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. He said this yesterday. McClellan insisted the process leading up to the decision to go to war was very public, and that the decision to invade in March 2003 was taken only after Iraq refused to comply with its international obligations. Oh, come on! We were all there! We all heard how eager the U.S. was to go to war. Unbelievable. I mean, do you remember this? It was about 3 years ago, and basically the U.S. was insisting that Saddam Hussein provide an itemized list of the things that he did not have. You know? He provided a list, but we didn't like the list. We didn't like what was on the list. So therefore, we said he was not cooperating. Yeah. The President of the United States, in a very public way, oh boy, reached out to people across the world, went to the United Nations and tried to resolve this in a diplomatic manner. You know, this guy, McClellan, if he's got a career in acting, if he can say that with a straight face, really. Saddam Hussein was the one in the end who chose continued defiance, and only then was the decision made, as a last resort, to go into Iraq. A last resort. Earlier this month, the Times of London published the minutes of a meeting of top British officials in mid-2002, including Prime Minister Tony Blair. According to those minutes, the British official, identified as C, I don't know why they do it that way, said that he had returned from a meeting in Washington and that military action was now seen as inevitable by U.S. officials. Mid-2002. Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD, but the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. That's according to the British memo. The minutes also quoted the unnamed British official as saying the U.S. National Security Council had no patience with taking the dispute to the United Nations and no enthusiasm for publishing material on the Iraqi regime's record. That I remember. That's pretty clear. And a lot of people knew that back then. I mean, if you listen to members of the United Nations at the time when they were trying to convince the United States not to do this, it was obvious that the U.S. wanted to go to war. They didn't want to negotiate. They were the ones who ordered the weapons inspectors out of the country because they were about to start bombing it. The memo also quoted British Defense Secretary Jeff Hoon as saying that the final push to war would likely begin a month before the U.S. congressional elections in November 2002, with an actual attack coming in January 2003. Well, they postponed it a little bit. But Democratic members of Congress are cautiously starting to voice some kind of partial criticism of George W. Bush. They sent a letter asking for an explanation. Don't send a letter. You sit in front of the guy's door. You take a lesson from the Canadians, and you become loud and vociferous. And yes, maybe offensive, but you have to do that when hundreds of thousands of people are dead as a result of a failed policy and a bunch of lies. Their letter said, the memo raises troubling new questions regarding the legal justifications for the war as well as the integrity of your administration. Oh, boy. We need to inject these Democrats with something. I don't know what, but it's definitely not enough what they have right now. Okay, they arrested the Cuban bomber. You hear about this case? This is an anti-communist militant accused of bombing a Cuban airliner in 1976. Yeah, you know, these things aren't really told to us all that often, but yes, a commercial airliner in 1976 was downed allegedly by this anti-communist militant. But he has not been defined as a terrorist by the United States. In fact, he has been sheltered by the United States. He's wanted by both Cuba and Venezuela in connection with the attack. His name is Luis Posada Carriles. He was finally arrested. It came after hundreds of thousands of Cubans marched in Havana to urge the U.S. to hand him over. Mr. Posada Carriles was reportedly smuggled into the U.S. earlier this year. He denies any involvement in the plane bombing, which killed 73 people. But, you know, when someone who's anti-Castro denies involvement in a terrorist attack, I have the feeling that the Bush administration is a lot more likely to believe them than if, say, somebody with any Arab-sounding name whatsoever were to say the same thing. He was released from prison in Panama last year after outgoing President Meira Moscoso pardoned him in connection with an alleged plot to kill Castro in 2000. Now remember who put the President of Panama in power. Yes, that's right. We invaded Panama, too, for those of you who have short memories. Not that long ago, either. Recently declassified documents show Mr. Posada Carriles, who was born in Cuba but is a Venezuelan citizen, used to work for the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. I think we've pretty much painted all the colors of this picture. Venezuela has applied to the U.S. for Carriles to be deported to stand trial for the airliner attack, but officials in Washington have said they have no knowledge of his whereabouts. I'm not quite sure I understand that. If they have, if he's arrested, if he's being held someplace, then obviously they know where he is. We'll see what happens. We'll see how U.S. policy actually stands up to this kind of scrutiny. Okay, what else is going on? Well, I actually went out and bought a copy of Newsday yesterday. Not Newsday, Newsweek. Newsweek is the weekly magazine that has been in the news recently and has caused no end of commotion because of a story that I thought was in the issue I was buying yesterday, but it wasn't. I bought an issue for nothing. I mean, I bought it for about $4, but I mean, I bought it for no reason because I bought the wrong one. I thought that the one that was just coming out that hadn't yet hit the stands was the one that they addressed this story, but I wanted to read the actual story. But that was the week before, apparently. And searching all over the web yields nothing as far as finding this story that has caused such a commotion. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you will very soon. Because thanks to our research and destruction expert, Dave, we have tracked down the article, and we're going to read it to you. It's very short. Investigators probing interrogation abuses at the U.S. Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay have confirmed some infractions alleged in internal FBI emails that surfaced late last year. Among the previously unreported cases, sources tell Newsweek, interrogators, in an attempt to rattle suspects, flushed a Koran down a toilet and led a detainee around with a collar and dog leash. An Army spokesman confirms that 10 Gitmo interrogators have already been disciplined for mistreating prisoners, including one woman who took off her top, rubbed her finger through a detainee's hair, and sat on the detainee's lap. New details of sexual abuse, including an instance in which a female interrogator allegedly wiped her red-stained hand on a detainee's face, telling him it was her menstrual blood, are also in a new book to be published this week by a former Gitmo translator. These findings, expected in an incoming report by the U.S. Southern Command in Miami, could put former Gitmo commander Major General Jeffrey Miller in the hot seat. 2 months ago, a more senior general... Where did the story go? I think the line's cut off. Okay, well, I'm going to continue at the second column where it doesn't finish that sentence. The FBI emails indicate that FBI agents quarreled repeatedly with military commanders, including Miller and his predecessor, retired General Michael Dunleavy, over the military's more aggressive techniques. Both agreed the Bureau has their way of doing business, and DOD has their marching orders from the Secretary of Defense, one email stated, referring to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Sources familiar with the Southcom probe say investigators didn't find that Miller authorized abusive treatment, but given the complaints that were being raised, sources say the report will provoke questions about whether Miller should have known what was happening and acted to try to prevent it. An Army spokesman declined to comment. That story written by Michael Zikoff and John Garby, or Gary, very tiny print here. Okay, there was quite a reaction to that. All throughout Afghanistan, all throughout the Muslim world, people were outraged at hearing that someone had flushed a Koran down a toilet. And I'll read you part of a story that came out shortly after word of the Newsweek article got out. The United States should apologize to Muslims for the senseless desecration of the Koran, which has only strengthened the hands of fanatics and undermined efforts to build democracy, an Afghan newspaper said on Saturday. 16 Afghans have been killed and about 100 injured since violent anti-U.S. protests erupted on Wednesday over a report in Newsweek that U.S. military interrogators at Guantanamo Bay had desecrated the Quran. Protests spread across the Muslim world on Friday, with thousands taking to the street in Pakistan, Indonesia, and Gaza. The United States has tried to calm Muslim anger, saying disrespect for the Quran was abhorrent and would not be tolerated, and military authorities were investigating the allegation. But the Outlook newspaper said the United States must do more. The U.S. government should officially apologize to the Muslims of the world about the heart-wrenching act of desecration of the Holy Quran and immediately arrest and punish those who are responsible. Newsweek said in its May 9th edition, investigators probing abuses at the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay found that interrogators had placed Qurans on toilets and, in at least one case, flushed a holy book down the toilet. Meanwhile, in Washington, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, said an investigation has so far turned up no evidence of U.S. interrogators at Guantanamo Bay desecrating the Quran. They have looked through the logs. I swear to God, I did not know what I was saying when I said, I'm just reading a damn quote here. Oh, boy. They have looked through the interrogation logs, in addition, and they cannot confirm yet that there was ever a case of a toilet incident. Okay. Let's get real here. And by real, I mean, you know, not 24 real. Real as in the real world. All right, if you torture somebody, if you do something abhorrent, if you kill somebody, are you going to write it down in a logbook? Give me a break. They're looking in the log for references to this? Of course it's not going to be in the log. Is that the only thing they have to go on? Oh, my God. Well, they couldn't find it in the log. And, of course, all the pressure came down after this because, the Islamic world was in an uproar. And I have something to say about that, too. I mean, we have a war going on, or an invasion going on, an occupation. We have film of torture. We have the fact of many, many people, many civilians, many innocent people, many soldiers and police as well, being killed as a result of ill-founded policy with no real plan. But the thing that gets people in the streets is flushing a book down a toilet? Yeah, okay, a holy book, but come on already. Let's have some priorities here. Yeah, you guys should be mad as hell. You should be throwing things at us. But not because someone's flushing a book down a toilet, because your people are being killed and murdered and your land is being desecrated and occupied. That's the reason. I mean, really? I smoked a joint once with a page of the Bible in Texas. Yeah. I'm out of control sometimes, but I wasn't lynched because of that. Well, of course, I didn't tell anybody either. Yeah, okay, wise move there. But the point is, all right, you know, it's a holy book. Regardless of what the United States says, of course, the holy book has been desecrated. And whether or not it shows up in a log someplace, trust me, it has. I mean, I've talked to people who go over there, and I've seen the way that they treat people. I've seen what they think of people. And this is not to not to in any way say that even most people who go over there feel this way. Because I know a lot of people who do go over there, who serve in the military, who are even cops, who are all kinds of people of varying pursuits, who are good in what they do, who respect people around them and find themselves sometimes in an impossible situation. But that said, there are a number big enough for it to be a big problem. A number of people who don't respect those people that are allegedly over there either to fight or to protect. I've heard members of the military desecrate the Quran in words, refer to the entire religion as a sexist, horrible, outdated, barbaric religion. So yeah, you know, I think it's quite possible that there are members of the military who take it a bit further. And while they're torturing a prisoner, yes, because we do know they torture prisoners, while they're doing that, they may say something insulting about the Quran. They may rip pages out of the Quran. They may flush the Quran down the toilet. But they won't ever smoke a joint with it, because that's not right. That's against army policy. So yeah, you know, it happened. I'm sure it did. Whether it happened in this particular case, who's to say? No one's going to keep a log when it does. But the pressure really came down on Newsweek, and of course, in that inimitable style that American media has, when pressured by the government, they back off completely. We regret that we got any part of our story wrong and extend our sympathies to victims of the violence and to the U.S. soldiers caught in its midst. And this is obviously because they were asked to prove that this happened and they could not. They report, actually, let me quote the actual story again so that we know what our facts are. Among the previously unreported cases, sources tell Newsweek, interrogators, in an attempt to rattle suspects, flushed a Koran down a toilet. First of all, you can't flush an entire Koran down a toilet. All right, so right away, you know something's not completely right with that. If they did, there's got to be a record of a backed-up toilet someplace in Guantanamo Bay. But sources told Newsweek this. Now, did sources lie? It's possible. It's definitely possible sources lie. They do it all the time. But sources say a lot of things, and they remain anonymous, and their particular quotes don't get dissected to this degree. It doesn't take away from the very good possibility that it was true. And even if it were not true, that there's a certain hatred and a certain lack of human respect going on in these places, as we heard from George Galloway only moments ago. But boy, yeah, that really got people in a tizzy over there. You know, I hope that they focus their attention on the real injustices. We'll see what happens with this. But Newsweek, they're the ones, it's their fault, they're the problem, not the torture, not the occupation, and not whatever other disrespect is going on. And of course, there was a situation in Uzbekistan. This is very interesting. If you've been paying any attention at all to the news, I know a lot of people don't, but you really should. There were demonstrations in the street in Uzbekistan. Now, if you recall, a couple of months ago, I believe Kyrgyzstan, I'm sorry, there's so many of them, Kyrgyzstan actually kicked out its government in a couple of days because it was totalitarian. Now, the same basic thing started to happen in Uzbekistan. Difference being, Uzbekistan authorities opened fire on the crowd, killing hundreds. Yeah, they killed hundreds of people who were peacefully demonstrating. Now, if you read the media in this country, you saw the most bizarre thing. You saw the demonstrations described as violent. Violent, and every single description, every single mention of this, the word violent was there. Yeah, it was violent when they started getting mowed down by machine guns. But no one ever referred to the Tiananmen Square massacre as a violent demonstration. They referred to the massacre. So why is this being referred to differently? Why are they implying that the demonstrators were the ones who were violent, the unarmed demonstrators? And yeah, you know, I'm sure there are some violent people in the midst. I know a prison was raided. It had some political prisoners in there. Things do happen. But you have to differentiate between the people who are doing one set of actions and the people who are doing something else. I know it's very difficult, but it's important, especially when reporting the news. So the question remains, why? Why is this different than what happened in the Ukraine, than what happened in Georgia, than what happened in Kyrgyzstan, than what happened in Eastern Europe? Well, turns out the United States has a bunch of bases, or at least one very big base in Uzbekistan, and they are the another set of quote-unquote allies. The government there is an ally in the fight against terror. So the United States said nothing. Days went by before the United States condemned the killings. And that was the reason. That was the reason because this totalitarian government is a friend of ours. So in all the other cases of all the other ex-Soviet republics, we were right there saying, Russia, stay out of this. Let the people decide. But this time, no, we're let's hope it works out, and that the Islamic militants, that's right, they must be Islamic militants. They don't topple their regime and instill a regime of terror, because that's what they're going to do, right? And that's what the Uzbekistan authorities were saying. I believe even Russia signed on to this, that it was an Islamic movement that was trying to subvert the authorities. Now, never mind the authorities are a brutal dictatorship. Forget that. The mere fact that there are Muslims involved here, that's enough to completely make the whole thing not worth discussing any further. But yeah, it did happen. It was very shameful, and it continues. And if it continues much further, the United States is going to be in a rather difficult position. Sort of like the position they're in Pakistan, where a rather dictatorial regime is supported, non-democratic, because they're helping us. Same thing in Saudi Arabia, same thing in Kuwait. Hey, Kuwait, they got women gained the right to vote finally. Hallelujah! Sure did take a long time after we allegedly freed them from oppression. So maybe the rest of the world will catch up if we keep invading other countries. All right, a British documentary arguing U.S. neoconservatives have exaggerated the terror threat is set to rock the Cannes Film Festival. In fact, I think it already did rock the Cannes Film Festival this weekend. Just like Fahrenheit 9/11 did last year, The Power of Nightmares re-injected politics into the festival. It was made by filmmaker and senior BBC producer Adam Curtis. Kept an audience of journalists and film buyers glued to their seats and taking notes for a full 2.5 hours. The film argues that the fear of terrorism has come to pervade politics in the United States and England, even though much of that angst is based on carefully nurtured illusions. It says Bush and U.S. neoconservatives, as well as British Prime Minister Tony Blair, are exaggerating the terror threat in a manner similar to the way earlier generations of leaders inflated the danger of communism and the Soviet Union. It also draws especially controversial symmetries between the history of the U.S. movement that led to the neocons and the roots of the ideas that led to radical Islamism. Two conservative movements that have shaped geopolitics since 1945. Curtis's film portrays neocons Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, and Donald Rumsfeld as counterparts to Osama bin Laden and his deputy Amin al-Zawahiri in the two respective movements. During the Cold War, conservatives exaggerated the threat of the Soviet Union, the narrator says. In reality, it was collapsing from within. Now they're doing the same with Islamic extremists because it fits the American vision of an epic battle. Well, that's a film I want to see. The Power of Nightmares. Hopefully that will be making its way over to this country at some point. And, the Mexican president. Boy, he put his foot in his mouth, didn't he? You hear this one? Mexican President Vicente Fox has called two American civil rights leaders and told them he regretted any... How did he get their phone numbers, I wonder? Must be a hotline if you offend somebody, offend an entire race of people. Well, these are the numbers to call to make it right. These are the phone numbers. He regretted any offense to African Americans when he said Mexican immigrants in the United States take jobs that not even blacks want to do. Fox spoke separately by phone with Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, according to a statement from the Mexican Foreign Ministry. The statement said Fox invited them to Mexico to join forces on working for immigration rights and civil rights for immigrants in the United States. Fox told the men that he regretted if he offended the African-American community and said he has great respect for the African-American community. I guess he said the same thing twice in a row like that, according to the statement. The ministry said Fox understands the African-American community has worked hard to fight against discrimination, and that as a result of that fight, the Mexican community in America has benefited greatly. In an interview on Fox News, not related to Vicente Fox, Sharpton said the phone call was a step in the right direction, but he called on the Mexican president to issue a formal apology. If, in fact, what he expressed to me on the phone was so, then he needs to demonstrate that those statements, one, do not reflect how he feels, and two, he needs to formally apologize. Jackson did not immediately return a telephone call seeking comment, but on Saturday he called the remark a spurious comparison with ominous racial overtones. But if you look through that, if you look through the racism that's inherent in the actual statement, what he says is true, that Mexicans are doing the jobs that nobody else wants to do. And Americans are benefiting greatly from that. And yet, we still feel compelled to turn them away from our borders, to chase them out of this country, to treat them like animals, to pay them pennies a day, to not give them any kind of health coverage. It's pretty pathetic and sad. I look forward to the day when those borders are open, where people can come and go. I mean, you know, we send people down there, or we send companies down there to be staffed by people who get paid pennies a day. We send companies to India, open up call centers there, pay people peanuts, maybe even literally, I don't know. But if they want to reciprocate in some way and get something out of this country, oh no, no, sorry. These doors are closed to you. You can't have it both ways, you know? And if this country is so prosperous because of all that we do in the rest of the world as far as taking advantage of cheap labor, then why shouldn't other people from other countries benefit from that? All right, let's read a couple of letters. And again, your letters are always welcome. OTW at 2600.com. And yes, we are still collecting letters for our upcoming fight with the FCC. It is coming up. Okay, dear Off the Wall, I first want to congratulate you, the USB staff, and your audience for doing so well during the Radiothon. We raised about $4,000 in 1 hour, which I'm still kind of stunned by. I also wanted to voice my support and be one of the 100 or hopefully more emails to fight the FCC. As a graphic designer, I thought a good idea would be to create downloadable posters that the audience could download, print, and post in their neighborhood. The poster could include a 2600/WUSB email address to write into, as well as the URL to the Off the Wall archives. I know that there are a lot of people out there who care about such issues, yet have not had the pleasure of listening to your show. Please let me know how I can help. Signed, Rick, from Waukesha, Wisconsin. And thanks very much for that letter. In fact, Rick also included a CD. I'm going to try and see if I can play this in the time that we have left. A Brain Damage remix that he created a year or so ago. Keep in mind, this was done with recordings that were available over the internet, so that's how they're going to sound. And of course, if you're listening over the internet, that doesn't really make a difference. Soon we hope to release the actual full quality editions of the program, but let's take a listen to this. I mentioned that I was traveling cross country.
I had a comma of some sort.
For that ever entertaining program, Eric Cawley's Brain Damage.
No, this is not the next Oprah Winfrey show. This is the current Brain Damage.
Nuclear weapon.
Technology has advanced amazingly.
Technology is cursed, believe me. Radio Free Long Island, in coordination with the Free Village Tobacco Farm, presents the Tripod Family, the story of one of America's most illustrious families and their struggle for peace and happiness in the suburbs of Long Island. Wait a minute. Did I get a yogurt twice?
Brain damage is back.
This is a toilet flushing error again. I mean, those roving homosexual gangs are a thing of the past. And I think the message is clear, folks. Tear down the malls.
Broadcast over a Mac. I mean, how much more technically adept can you possibly be in these days? Now, an iPod is a device that you basically copy MP3s onto. We have a record. Whenever we get a new Big Audio Dynamite record, we play it here. Big Audio Dynamite apparently has split up. 632-6901. This is Brain Damage. This is a call-in program, and I should say right at the top that... No, folks, I did not smoke crack. Albania, that is the answer, folks. Albania, yes.
To whom it may concern, I would like to address the issue of the quote-unquote radio program called Brain Damage, which has been airing on WUSB from midnight to 2 a.m. on Saturday night. In a few short weeks, you have managed to insult not only the intelligence of the few listeners who keep tuning into this drivel, but also you have insulted the late Richard Burton, former Vice President Dan Quayle, the entire Christian religion, the entire nation of Islam, Buddhists, Jews, American teenagers, foreign teenagers, male and female listeners above the age of 30, your fellow staff members of WUSB, the station manager of WUSB, the program director of WUSB, the custodial staff of the State University at Stony Brook, bus drivers at the State University at Stony Brook and the State University at Purchase, Albany, and Buffalo, pet owners, pets, the President of the United States, leaders of most members of the European community, football players, referees, the administration of the State University at Stony Brook, the Federal Communications Commission, Joey Buttafuoco, and in parentheses it says for not mentioning his name once on your program, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Weekly World News, Long Island Newsday, the New York Times, postal workers, and last but not least, telephone operators. I find it difficult to condone such activity, and so I will not, because I am not in the position of doing difficult things. It is my opinion and that of the person typing this letter that WUSB would better serve the community by broadcasting national public radio programs and classical music instead of the filth and blasphemy that has pervaded the airwaves in recent weeks. I must warn you that legal action is being contemplated in the wake of revelations that members of WUSB paid off local ministers in an attempt to keep objections to your newfound religion at a minimum. While this process is underway, you are hereby directed to play only classical music and not to let any more objectionable material go out over the air. I trust I have made my position on this matter clear. Sincerely, Chancellor. And P.S. Do not under any circumstances read this letter over the air. Apparently there's moles and spies and rats and things like that that listen to this show.
This is Brain Damage. We have no moral values. Why do I always get this lovelorn crap and Eric gets all the good stuff? Oh, I do have, let's see, Emmanuel Goldstein sitting within the booth over there?
Yes, and I have to be distorted to protect my identity. Life has not been the same. I have been stalked mercilessly day and night. I can never find any peace, no matter how hard I work.
Yeah.
Living heck. It is actually the brownies, and they are fairly merciless as far as when they target the particular team. They are inhuman. They know no mercy. Ask yourself, the Girl Scouts sell cookies. The Boy Scouts help old ladies across the street.
Yes.
Just what do the brownies do? The brownies are the brains. The brownies are the enforcers. Be careful of the brownies. They wear the same colors as New York City traffic enforcement. Think about it.
Oh my God, they found me. I gotta go.
Okay, that was something else. The memories that brings back. Oh my God. Well, thanks very much to our listener from Waukesha, Wisconsin, Rick, out there for taking the time to put that together. Clips from the old Brain Damage show, which used to air here on WUSB years ago, all of which is available online, www.2600.com/braindamage. wow. Brownies. You know, brownies makes me think about Amsterdam, because that's That's near where the hacker thing is going on this summer, and in fact, that's going to be one of the first stops in my round-the-world voyage, which will be aired here on this radio station through the marvels of technology. So if you're somewhere along the way if you're in Mongolia or China, Japan, places like that, definitely write into us, otw@2600.com. Maybe we can swing by your way as well. Let's read one more letter, then we're out of here for tonight. I don't know if this will count towards the 100 emails in protest of the FCC because it might be too late and I am from Canada. Well, you know, no. It won't count in the FCC's eyes. It certainly will count in ours. The level of paranoia in the States certainly seems ridiculous. I don't find attitudes, laws, or programming here in Montreal to be very progressive, open, or diverse, but by the sound of it, things are exponentially worse in the U.S. Yeah, you know, if you go to, like, Upper Moose Jaw or something in Saskatchewan or wherever it is, they're more progressive than anywhere in the United States. If you look at the kind of media that is broadcasting, just inherent in the system. Doesn't mean it's inevitable that it stay that way, but that's how it is right now, because we listen to this far right wing and we're afraid of them. Anyway, continuing here. The thing that gets me is that the people who support the FCC are seemingly too concerned about profanity and nudity on television to understand the importance of the civil liberties and virtues established by the framers of your Constitution. I should point out, I support the FCC. I support the existence of the FCC. I support what they do technologically, but I don't support the morality. I don't support the... all right, that came out wrong. I support morality, individual morality. I don't support their morality instilled upon everybody else. I don't support morality police, and that's not what the FCC should be doing. If they got back to technical issues, keeping us from straying into a different frequency, for instance, or from
overmodulating,
things like that. Don't anybody write in and report me for that, okay? Please. Besides, that wasn't overmodulating. That was just simply distortion. If they did that, then, they'd be doing a much better job at that, I think. Continuing with the letter, additionally, I don't understand how somebody cannot simply change the channel or station if they are dissatisfied or offended by the broadcast. I do that all the time. Commercial radio offends me. There are days I don't even go there. And it's easy. It's very easy not to listen to something. And if you're in the Christian right, you should know how easy it is not to listen to things. I'm sorry, that was nasty, but too good a line not to use. Additionally, I find it bizarre that many of the same people who freak out at the sight of a breast or the sound of a profane word have no problem being gun zealots who support capital punishment and feel they have a divine authority to tell people of less than common lifestyles and interests what to do. Well, that's a kind of thing to raise at 2 minutes to the hour. Long live Off the Wall, NWUSB, signed Garan from Montreal. I hope I pronounced your name right. Good luck. Hope you get a delay machine. We're working on it with listener support. There's nothing we can't do. All right, it's Emmanuel. I'm going to get back to whatever it was I was doing before I started this. See you next week. Same time, same place. Good night.